Welcome to Cyber Frontier, bringing you the latest news, trends, and hottest topics that focus on advances in cybersecurity and cyber industry economics. Our expert yet down-to-earth hosts make cybersecurity straightforward. They ask the tough questions and make this challenging topic something that everyone can understand. Our candid approach lets guests open up on topics we would all like to see addressed. You can find us on the web at newcyberfrontier.com. That's www.newcyberfrontier.com. Now join today's host as he introduces the topic for today's New Cyber Frontier.
Welcome back, everybody, to the New Cyber Frontier. This is Sean Murray. I've got a special guest this week, Dr. Richard Klodnicki. We're going to talk to him from ARIS. That's the name of his company. And welcome to the show, Doc. We're so happy to have you here.
Oh, my pleasure, Sean. My pleasure.
Hey, why don't you give us a little bit about your background? You know, we've known each other for many years, and we've been around the same territory. But give us some of your background. You're an academy grad, and you've got military background, and that all helps out with what you're doing today.
Roger that. So, as you said, right now I'm running my own company called Arity, and we opened that up in 2014. And one of the reasons for that was that as I was doing the work in the military, I really gained a lot of experience and exposure to quite a few different kinds of weapon systems and how they're controlled and the infrastructure behind them. And when I retired, I went into government contracting, and I got a chance to move into the science and technology side a lot more, and then move back into some of the operations and leadership. And I was very fascinated with how human beings make decisions in critical systems, and how those systems help them make those critical decisions. So why? Well, as you mentioned, I graduated from the academy in 85 and I went into ICBMs. That's a very critical decision. And then I was part of the team that was initial cadre on what was called MX back then, or the Peacekeeper missile. And so I got to work with the Air Force Operational Test and Evaluation Center. While I was an online ICBM crew member, I was pulled to go do testing for 6 months on MX, and then came back on crew and was part of the install teams for the MX Peacekeeper missile. And so what you learned was that there was a lot of effort that went into the infrastructure to make sure that the Launch Control Center can communicate clearly and cleanly with the launch facility and the ICBM that's in there. But there's also a lot of command and control associated with making sure that the person who is making the commit action, you know, as we say, turning the key, is actually doing that action when they should, how they should, at the time that they should. And so I continue to remain fascinated with how do we make these checklist issues relevant, operationally relevant to the problem at hand in other systems. So I got a chance to have some career broadening, as you mentioned, and I went to the Air Force Academy and I taught leadership there. And so I was continuing to look at how is it that people are making decisions? What are the decisions that are most important to them? And what's the information that they need? So that, you know, the information, knowledge, wisdom, right? Data, information, knowledge, wisdom. And then from a decision maker perspective, I got offered to go get the PhD, as you mentioned. And that was also fascinating. So I got a chance to also work with some international students and see how different cultures view information and how they use that to develop decisions and execute on their goals. So then when you and I met, you know, we were looking at government systems that were closed, and we'd started to do information assurance as an aspect of interoperability. So how does the command and control system that delivers the information to you interoperate with the person, the warfighter, and with the weapon system, so that you are doing exactly what it is you want to do, when you want to do it, and that you control not doing it. And as we know, IA went from to DITSCAP, then DIACAP, and then NIST, and that's when you and I were working on the command and control systems for Missile Defense Agency. So still equally fascinated by that, but then we opened the aperture, and we went from closed systems to using the internet. And now you're in a different environment, because the internet was originally designed to be for sharing. And sharing is not prone to prohibitive conversations.
Right.
But to add that aspect of cybersecurity, you have to prohibit. You have to deny access to those who ought not have access. So that became the next step for me, logical step for me, to get into cybersecurity. So that's how I got to where I am right now.
That's awesome. And so we've been talking with Doc Klodnicki, Dr. Richard Klodnicki from, say the name of your company again?
Arity. It's Arity. Greek. It means fulfill your potential.
Okay. Well, that's perfect. We're going to take a break for our sponsor right now, and we'll come right back with Doc Klodnicki.
Cyber Resilience Institute helps build strong cyber communities designed to prevent members from attack. Like building a neighborhood watch, it takes coordination and a sharing community to protect our identities and valuables in the virtual world. Typically, we hear that organizations know they need to do something to protect their cyber assets, but don't know where to begin. Let Cyber Resilience Institute help your community create an action plan. Cyber Resilience Institute will build your community or business marketplace so that it is designed to support a collective cyber defense. Contact them for more information at cyberresilienceinstitute.org.
Welcome back. We're talking to Doc Klodnicki from Arity. He is the president and CEO. Well, we've been talking to you about, you know, your background. So back in 1985, when, I mean, that was still the Cold War, right?
Yeah, it was.
And
yeah.
What's funny is, so you're an officer working in that environment. In 1985, when I graduated from high school, I went in the Air Force. I was a 463.
Oh,
I was
okay.
A nuke maintainer, yeah. Alcom Shrams, Minuteman Threes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I was the guy, the mechanic, tearing that stuff apart, putting them back together. And so you were on the other side. You're the person that had the ability to look and see those command and control systems. And so to your point, those were closed systems.
Yes.
Right? The national critical weapon systems.
Yes.
And, you know, today, fast forward 30 some, we'll just say 30 plus years. Yeah, it really is a, collaborative, today we connect almost everything. Even our weapon systems traverse the internet, even if they're encrypted with type 1 encryption. But so there's still risk. There's still threats associated with how we do that. And when you're talking about a national critical weapon system, what is it in today, all the things that you've learned across your journey, what is it that keeps you up at night?
So I still think with the biggest issue that we have, yes, we're connected. But even back in the Cold War, right? So you had redundant communications with these critical systems. So we were hardwired, you know, through the ground from our launch control center to the launch facility. And then when you're talking to satellites, you know, everything at the ground station is very well isolated and controlled, and it was on its own net.
Sure.
But now you have to send electromagnetic, and that's no longer in your control. So you had to go, you know, so you're looking at how do you encrypt it, how do you control it, how do you check to make sure it was or wasn't listened to. Now you're into spectrum management. Yeah, that was a fun board for us, wasn't it? And so you know, when we had hard lines and cables, you could put them into pressurized cabling, and then if there was a break-in, you'd have a pressure change, you'd get a warning. Hey, someone's trying to get to your cable. What do you have now? When you're transmitting through the atmosphere, right, and exoatmospherically, how do you know that what you just said made it to where it needs to go? You know, so now you develop things like checksums and handshakes and protocols. Okay, so we're doing all those things, but they serve two purposes: one, to ensure that the information is what you intended it to, and that the receiver gets it. So again, it's a communication issue, but the other aspect is to make sure that other people who ought not get it don't get it. And what I found fascinating is in the last 5 years, I've been doing work on going after contracts that are in an arena in the what we call the C4ISR.
Yep.
So those Intel platforms. And what I'm finding is that the work that I'm doing now is on the follow-on systems that, as I read the unclassified documents, turns out my dad had been working on when he was active duty. And so you begin to find out that we've been doing satellite communications for weather, for example, for a very long time. And when we did that, we learned a lot about the atmosphere. We learned a lot about the transmission medium through which we're sending these signals. And so when you talk about, you know, your Wi-Fi and your Bluetooths and all these disconnected by cable communication systems, there's a lot of interference. Well, that also means there's a lot of chance for someone to suck that data across. And, you know, why? So why, when you go to a hotspot, how careful are you? Who do you use to help make sure that what you're communicating is controlled? And you can use encryption, and that's a really good sense. But what if you're not transmitting at that time? How do you know someone's not trying to break in? So you have encryption at rest, encryption at transmission, and then how do you calculate the aspects associated with encryption and its security? How many digits out? You know, right now we're at 256, and the idea is that it's not going to be easy to crack. Okay.
Yeah, when you're talking about, you know, satellite communications, yeah, for example, you still have to maintain performance.
Right.
So, you know, on, you know, we're not talking about, you know, an E1, E2 connection. When we're talking about spectrum management,
right,
we're talking about radio waves, we're talking about light, we're talking about many different ways to communicate. I add encryption, I degrade my capability perform. So
you're right.
It's a trade-off, right?
Yeah, yeah, and it has to be. So if, you know, we call it bandwidth, but, you know, if you look at it in a very rudimentary sense, I have 10 units of space to put a transmission out. And in that, I have to have, you know, a timing so I can do a sync, I have to do a handshake, I have to do encryption. And if each of those are one, I now have 7 units left for the message that I actually want to send.
Right.
What if you have an 8-unit message? And where do you break it? How do you do it? Now you got to packet it, okay? And now you're going crisscross these medians and sharing, which is why spectrum management is so important. So through no fault of our own, the thing that keeps me up at night is making sure that we have those tactics, techniques, and procedures, and those subsequently come from policies. And so when you start moving up the, I don't want to say up the hierarchy, but when you start moving up the decision-making hierarchy, the policymakers may or may not be the practitioners. And so I often say that a person's career is practitioner, supervisor, manager, leader, executive.
Sure.
Okay. So the executives are making executive decisions that may or may not have been in the best interest of the communications. And that's what we found. I mean, we found that in the late 1990s, early 2000s, which is why we went to information assurance. I didn't blame the warfighter for focusing on the tools of the trade and not so much on the comm. There weren't a lot of adversaries, though, for us. But as we started to become more and more interconnected, we increased the number of adversaries. And so our cybersecurity has to be tighter because the number of threats are tighter. And so when you do fail some of the basic hygiene issues, don't share your password, one user account per person, not per team. You know, these kinds of simple things, key lock, screen lock your computer before you leave, otherwise you're buying a dozen
donuts.
The
basics, right?
Yeah. I mean, if you do those three things, you can really mitigate a lot of problems. You make it harder. So now you have these phishing experiments, and there's a lot of human intelligence that goes into finding out ways to break into a system. So human beings, God bless us, right? We're wonderful, and we're not perfect, right? Well, you know. So
present company. Yeah.
Yes, you are, Sean. So what do you do to mitigate those human problems without what I, you know, the term is pite, poke in the eye, without pite.
Sure.
You know, don't poke people in the eye and say, look, you're the weakest link. We kind of get that. We know that, you know, which is why all these sci-fi movies are so cool about these robots and artificial intelligence. They won't make mistakes. Yeah, they do.
But they have to be programmed by humans.
Humans, right?
Right?
And even then, the aspect of the human condition and the decision-making, which goes back to the things that I've been studying for 30, 40 years and writing about, are that it is rarely the opportunity for you to say, here are two options. One is clearly good. One is clearly not the one you want to make. More often than not, it's here's a decision that needs to be made, and here are two options.
Right.
Both of them are terrible. Both of them will cause, you know, either bodily harm or death. And you had to pick one. And now you go into all these different theories and whatnot, and they're not worth talking about here. But you start saying, okay, what do I have to do? I have to make a decision. So I have human beings running these systems, but I also know that human beings are going to be the weakest link in a say. As simple as, did I set the right IP address? Did I set the right gate? I mean, the difference between one setting and not, then all of a sudden your back door is wide open. Well, in a house, how many times have you know, let the dog out, come in, and your wife's like, why is the door open? You go, my bad, again,
right?
So if you're going to do that letting out the dog, what's to say you're not going to do that letting out your data?
Sure.
So how can we do those things to help the human existence to be less frail and less prone to attack? So encryption's one way, right?
Sure.
And then the policies associated with how you manage the data. And just because you have those policies. So for example, you say, and this happens in companies, right? It happened in the government. I remember on active duty, this kind of thing would happen. Hey, I need access to these files. Well, sir, I need you to get this form. So listen, the general needs the briefing. Okay, I'll just give it to you here right now, right? Or whatever the excuse was. Well, now, again, that person's stuck with two bad decisions. Do I, A, stand in the way of what the general needs because he's got to make a decision, or she has to make a decision about something important, or do I stand firm to the, no one's allowed access unless this form is filled out and signed by somebody, and that somebody's on vacation.
Well, and this is a great point to make, because you talked about, you know, from executives down to the practitioner.
Right.
So you've got strategy. We pass strategy down to be the operational level.
Mm-hmm.
We set objectives.
Yeah.
We pass those down to the task level. So that's where your tactics come in, and then your operators operate. But everybody should understand why you're doing what you're doing. Balancing the needs of the business with the overall strategy. I can't have so much security, I can't do my job. So the general needs the information right away from from executive position, and this is what I try and tell my CISOs is, you know, somebody's not meeting the requirement. We don't just, the operational mindset is, no, enforce the policy. The answer is no.
Mm-hmm.
Management strategic is, there's got to be a reason why the individual's not wanting to do this. What is the situation? Let's analyze that. Allow what needs to be accomplished with the least amount of risk. We've got to balance the needs of the business.
And I think we saw that with the DITS cap, DIA cap, right? And then movement from, you know, stricture and checklists and you know, no, you can't, you violated this, to it's a risk. Let different people.
Day, it's all about risk.
Balancing the risks associated with your decisions. And so we begin to look at that. So now you're not talking about the general, but let's say you're talking about the vice president for engineering. All right, and they've got a CAD that they need, okay? But the CAD's on, you know, it's on a thumb drive. Why is it on a thumb drive? It's supposed to be on SharePoint, so that way, is it, well, you know, we allowed him to work from home, whatever the excuse was.
Sure.
And, you know, he used his daughter's thumb drive to bring it into work, and it turns out it was plugged into the elementary school, and it wasn't clear, and bam, now we have a virus. And you go, okay, I understand what we did. Now let's go fix that and put in place a policy for that. You know, and in DOD, they just disallowed all the externals, right? I mean, you're shutting off your DVD drives and all this other stuff, and no more CD read writes, and it's all. And the big question then was, how do I create data and get it into the system then, right? And so it's like, that's an excellent point. How do you create data and put it into a system that is secured, you know, cyber secured, and it's secured by these walls and these processes and these procedures. And so that's another balancing act. But the other one, and I'm glad you brought that up, is, you know, you talk about these as columns, right? And balancing. So you balance cost, schedule, and performance. And we used to balance cybersecurity. We're turning that column on its side and calling it a foundation step now. And it is less and less part of your opportunity to make a trade-off. You know, there's 31 states now that have criminal laws against data loss if you didn't do what you're supposed to do.
Due diligence, right?
Yeah. So that can't be a variable that you're allowed to adjust as you see fit, because you put your corporate assets at risk if you're going to be brought up on criminal charges, and you put yourself at risk.
That's a great point. We're going to come back and continue that conversation. We're talking to Dr. Richard Klodnicki, and we're going to break for our sponsor right now. We'll be right back.
Security Services are your cybersecurity experts with decades of experience providing professional training services for our clients in various industries. We offer professional training and certification in areas of cybersecurity, safety, health, and environmental services at our academy. Our in-person and online training provides a collaborative environment where students can interact directly with instructors through live chats or in private classrooms. Visit murraysecurityservices.com for more information.
Welcome back to the new Cyber Frontier. I'm Sean Murray. We have Dr. Richard Kladnicki from Aerotees. We're having that discussion about, on that government mindset, how we've evolved over the last 30 plus years. And, you were talking about how we balance the needs of the business. At the end of the day, it really is about risk. And so when we take a look at data today, in the way that the government, for instance, is doing business, we're not investing, billions of dollars in satellite constellations. We're doing hosted payloads on commercial satellites because they have the redundancies that are in there, right? So I can do a hosted payload on something like Iridium, and now I only have to protect that host and the feeds that are going. So it goes back to the opportunities, but then you introduce additional risk.
Right.
We talk about the human element.
Right.
You and I both cut our teeth with trying to change the culture of information and cybersecurity,
yeah,
on several programs to include some weapon systems. And at one point, somebody finally, lifts their head up out of the sand and says, "Wow, this really is a good idea, and my data is really important." And how do I change the culture of those individuals that are leaders and decision makers so that they understand that risk and they can effectively manage it better?
That's a really good question, and I don't want to sound like I'm pontificating, but I'm going to back it off from a historical perspective, right? So industrial age, right, it's about how faster you can replicate, right? So now you're moving into, the Ford, right, Model T. How do you build these things? How do you replicate it? Or Hershey's chocolates, all of them went to,
sure,
this mechanized repeatability, okay? Then what was key there was information. Why was information key? Because it took a while for information to go from one place to the other. Even with the telegraph, someone still had to get the telegraph to you,
right,
physically to you. Well, and then the newspapers were able to be transmitted over hardwire, and they could be printed at any part in the country. And then you had satellite television, live transmission, I remember that, okay? I also remember sitting there watching the lunar landings, right? I mean, my brother and I, my parents still have that picture in the house. So now I'm watching on television, 250,000 miles away on the moon, the astronauts. And it's like, wow, that's instantaneous. So then what ends up happening is you have these strictures that businesses put for competitive reasons, and the government puts for national security reasons,
right,
on instantaneous information. Well, for a long time there were very few people that were able to look up at satellites and track them and use software to figure out what's going on. Now you can go on Twitter, and there are so many people out there who are at home or even at college doing space situation awareness. So they're watching these satellites, and they're saying, "Hey, I'm noticing this." And so no longer is anything secret in space from the perspective of observability.
Sure.
Now, the data that it's collecting, why it's collecting it, what it's doing is still secure. But, as General Hyten and General Raymond here in town have both mentioned, the contested, congested, and all of his staff, they're doing a fantastic job pointing out what's different now from when I was a kid and when I was a junior officer working on space systems and,
right,
the controls that you have to put on them. It's no longer as protected in that sense. So you have to find different ways to protect it. So information is now rapid. And let's look at what's going on, say, with the coronavirus, right? And I'm not saying one side or the other is right or wrong. I'm just saying there's a prevalent amount of information that says
immediate
all you have to
access to information.
Yes. All you have to do is wash your hands, sneeze into your elbow, not shake hands, and you're going to be fine. And then the other side, there's, $30 for a roll of toilet paper here in town. Seriously.
Right.
Yeah. And it's like, oh, my goodness, are you kidding me? we're having a run on, you know, so you kind of go, okay, but you have to understand, how did these people get to that decision? Because they were told this, then they were told this, then they were told this.
And well, and then, you know, the social media aspect of it as well, right?
Exactly.
Not just the media, but the
both
social
of them,
media.
Right. And so let's say you're on Twitter and you've only followed these kinds of people, you're going to get confirmation bias. So if you're towards the side of, I'm going to ride this out, everything's going to be fine, you're probably going to be a lot more calm about this. If the folks that you've been listening to have been saying, look, this can kill you, here's the, you know, which it can, obviously, but at these levels, and you need to do this and this, then that's how you're going to react, because
sure,
that's your information flow. That's how you are teaching yourself. So information now is instantaneous. It's moderately unfiltered in that sense. And it supports the confirmation bias, which has always been part of the human condition, is to confirm what it is you already
right.
believe. So now when you go in and let's say, you know, well, remember when Julian Assange, right, and he published the Democrat emails. Some people are saying that's hacking, that's illegal. Others are saying, why did the newspapers that printed it not get in trouble for hack? And these are legitimate questions. I'm not saying I'm right
sure.
or wrong. I'm saying these are legitimate questions to have about what do you do with information and who owns it. Well, then you get other companies that get the, you know, unless you pay me, I'm going to hold ransom all of your data.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, that clearly is bad actor, okay? Clearly going into someone's system and taking their data, that's bad actor. As a journalist going out and asking questions and having someone tell you these things, or as a whistleblower saying, look, this is wrong, or within the world of corporate intelligence and gaining information on your competitors, those all have legal constrictions to them that allow you to continue to call it competitive intelligence versus theft.
Right.
Right? They allow you to call it journalism versus theft. Right? They allow you to call it whistleblower versus whatever they call it, breaking the chain of command. Right?
Sure.
So we're building these policies and we're building these procedures and we're building these tactics, techniques, and procedures associated with the profession. It's a new profession. So it's going to be in tune with higher variance. So you're going to get swings of the pendulum that are going to be much greater, and then it's going to come back to the norm. I mean, nowadays, I think half of the United States population has never walked into the kitchen and had the phone cord from the phone go across their neck. And that half that's listening to right now is going, I have no idea what you're talking about. The other half is going, oh, yeah, I remember that when Dad was on the phone or Mom was on the phone.
Right.
You walk into the kitchen.
It was 100 miles long.
Yeah, it was a 50-foot that was stretched 100, right?
My sister was always on it.
Yeah. Okay, so it's a very different approach. But now, you know, you pick up this cell phone right here that's beside me. It's called a cell phone or a mobile phone, you know.
Smartphone these days, right?
Smartphone.
More technology than was on the first
edition. Yeah, but it still says P-H-O-N-E. So why do you get the question, Dad, what is the save icon? What is that? What do you mean? Well, it's a square with a circle in the middle. What is that? Oh, it's a floppy disk. What's a floppy disk? Right? So why is this still called a phone? Why isn't it called a communications computer
right.
or something? You know, so it something.
Costs as much as one these days.
Yeah, yeah. And so what? But what do I do with this? How do I control the data on that? What is and isn't secure? And now you have to start looking at what's the business case for adding these security features. So we go back to that 10 unit, right? One unit for timestamp, one unit for delivery address, one unit for cyber, and now your
right.
10 unit is down to 7 available. How much do I really need to protect data such as, hey, Mom, I'm home for dinner in half an hour, or hey, honey, I'm going to stop by the store. Anything you want me to get? Big deal.
Right.
Hey, can you put $200 in my checking account? Here's the number. Here's the routing number. Okay, now.
That's different.
Right.
Right.
So, you know, we used to be very cautious about what we wrote down. Nobody ever wrote down their Social Security number. Everybody's Social Security number, you know, is breached on a regular basis. You know, personal identifiable information. What are we doing to protect this stuff? Just because it has been doesn't mean we don't continue to stay true to the hygiene,
yeah.
right? And so that's why the coronavirus is really kind of, I see that as a really good connection with cybersecurity, right? There are certain hygiene things you need to do. So if you wash your hands, if you sneeze into your, you know, tissue or into the your elbow, if you don't shake hands, if you wash down the surfaces, okay. If you have a password, if you make sure that you've got some kind of virus checker on your internet providing capabilities, softwares, I don't want to say anyone in particular.
Right.
And if only you have your name, and when you're done, you clear your cache, right? Throw away your trash,
yep.
wipe down your surface. You're in a pretty good situation.
Hygiene is hygiene.
Hygiene is hygiene.
Good hygiene is good hygiene. Yeah. Bad hygiene is bad hygiene.
Right. And
more
what's
risk
the
with bad hygiene, right?
And so now let's say you're about ready to sneeze, but the dog just jumped up on you and, you know, one of your kids just asked you a question and you turn and now you've just sneezed out into the dining room. And then you get the look that you deserve. Why didn't you cover your mouth, Dad? Okay. Why didn't you, you know, lock your screen? Why didn't you put your password in a secure location?
A vulnerable moment.
Vulnerable moment because we're human. So you asked at the beginning, what is it that keeps me up? It's that we're human and that we make mistakes. So what can we do to mitigate those mistakes? And there's lots of things, you know, that we can do, that the computer companies, I'll just use that in a broad sense, both those that are providing hardware, software, app, you know, and I know apps and software, but you know what I mean, operating systems,
sure,
all that, they're constant, it is in their best interest to be secure. So while there might be a perceived governmental pressure for these companies to be a certain way and behave a certain way, there's also market pressure. If I go to company A and they say, I can provide you a 63% cybersecurity, I go, okay, yeah, for how much? $25 a month. You go, okay. I go to the company B and they say 75 for 30 bucks a month. You go, okay. 90% for 15. You're going, whoa. Less money, higher security. Guess who's going to get the business?
Sure.
Guess what companies A and B are going to do? They're going to bump up their cybersecurity capabilities and they'll adjust the cost appropriately. So the market factors are driving a lot of what we're doing in the cybersecurity environment.
Sure.
The question is, are they doing it fast enough? Now, you have nation state actors who are not limited by budget. Companies are, I won't say limited, but it's a factor. So how does, say, Arity, right, or Murray Enterprises, how do you protect against a nation state actor? Well, you kind of have to take cover in a system that has already been designed from the perspective of nation state actors coming at it. So,
sure.
So you lease a service. What do other smalls do and how much does it cost is the next question.
Man, this has been a great conversation. We could do this all day. Well, we've been talking to Doc Klodnicki, Richard Klodnicki from Arity's, his company. Great conversation.
Thank you, Sean.
We're going to continue that on. That's it for this session for the New Cyber Frontier. I'm Sean Murray. Thank you for joining with us today, Doc, and
sure
sharing
did.
Your perspectives.
You betcha. My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to New Cyber Frontier. Remember to follow or like our post and circulate each new show to your networks. We keep you informed, bring you the latest news, explore new trends, and find the hottest topics. With New Cyber Frontier, you don't have to be a computer or cybersecurity expert. Just get plugged in. We encourage you to get involved. Tell us what topics interest you and join our mailing lists. You can find us on the web at www.newcyberfrontier.com. That's newcyberfrontier.com. Check out our previous interviews and please let us know if there are any topics that you would like to hear discussed. See you next time on New Cyber Frontier.